I'll give you my title, and I wanted to make it a little bit colorful today, so I surfed the web a little for you. I want to talk about a mathematical theory of water waves, and so this is for today, where we're at the Fields Institute, showing the and contrasting and advertising the different graduate programs in the area. I thought it was Ontario, but I think it's really quite extended, at least east of Ontario. And this is one of my favorite woodcuts by Hokusai, The Great Wave. It's one of the 100 views of Mount Fuji, and it's a gorgeous and dramatic, and you might say not really terribly realistic woodcut. This was made about 1800. Hokusai was a famous artist and woodblock cutter, Japanese, from late 1700s to early 1800s. And anyway, just keep this in mind as we go through the other slides. And what I want to talk about is a theory. Oh, actually, I have the luxury of a two-slide projector, so let's try to do this so that when I write an equation down and zip by it, you'll have a little bit more chance to take down this down in your notes. You're taking notes, aren't you? So I want to describe a theory of waves in the ocean surface. And I guess one of the things I'm going to say is why today. But it is fascinating to, I've always, since I was a kid, I grew up in California, and you're right on the, you know, pretty close to the coast, and it is fascinating to see waves in constant motion. Joyce said, I guess, in Finnegan's Wake, he called it the ever-changing, never-changing sea. It's just remarkable, and it's fun. You know, it's beautiful to watch, and it's powerful. And some reasons, plenty of reasons, you might want to have a theory which would tell you what waves are going to do if you want to design structures like ships or breakwaters or harbors, or predict tsunamis or other ways. But I'm getting ahead of myself. What I need to do for any mathematical theory of water waves. Actually, what I am going to talk about today is problems that mathematicians look at from various points of view that are motivated by physics. So it has a little bit of a contrast with number theory, which is a mathematically motivated problem. I tend to like problems motivated by physics. And to tell you my other personal prejudices, I like problems that depend on time. It's just, I mean, no reason other than that's my own personal liking. I like things moving and changing. So this is one of them. So let's establish coordinates first. So I drew a coordinate axis, and y I'm going to take as a vertical axis. I'm going to be a flat Earth person for this talk, meaning we're talking about Lake Ontario, not necessarily the Pacific Ocean, at least in these coordinates. And so therefore, my world is going to be Rn. I'm going to have y, a special vertical coordinate, and gravity, constant gravity, pulling down. I didn't put in new gravity, but I guess I should have. And then all horizontal variables are going to be called x, x1, x2. I mean, we're mathematicians, so it could be x3. I mean, it's a problem that we can study most reasonably, of course, in two or three dimensions. So x will be in r1 or r2. In any case, that's the horizontal variables. And the fluid domain then is between, for you take all x, so it's a big C. I'm not going to consider the surf on the shore, well, at least not in this talk. And then y, I want to be between the bottom and the top. And part of the problem is to define the top. Now, the bottom very often is idealized to be flat, or maybe at minus infinity, but could certainly have rocks, topography, the Marianas Trench, other things in it. And then how do you describe? So now I have a domain. Everything below a surface, which I penned in blue, and everything above the bottom. Now how do you describe a fluid? Well, there are a variety of waves. One way, and it will be convenient for us to do it here, will be every point in this fluid domain, I want to describe a velocity field. And that's a point in space and time, and that's where the fluid particle, that's the velocity of the fluid particle at that point doing that thing. And also, I'm going to say the free surface is a graph. Y is equal to eta of x and t. As I've drawn it, it looks like a graph. And now I need equations that we're going to give some relationship between U and eta and everything else that I need to in the problem. And those equations will be partial differential equations. And in fact, that's my real field, is the analysis of partial differential equations. And so the problem is to describe the time evolution of the surface eta and the fluid velocity U. And now immediately, you see there's a problem with what I've done, because look at this thing, it's turning over. I could focus it a little bit better, I think. You know, there's a focal plane problem with this particular one. Look at the bulb is out of the, not at the focal point. But anyway, there, that's a great wave. It's turning over. It's not a graph anymore. Well, there are ways of dealing with that when you have surf or overturning waves. A variety of waves, in fact. One might be, some people have heard of, might have heard of Lagrangian coordinates. So that's a possibility. And there are others, and it should be up to us for our mathematical convenience and for its usefulness. So before I give you those equations, I want to talk a little bit about history. Well, where does the problem come from? Well, mankind has been sailing the seas for since prehistory, so it's been of concern since prehistory. But the analysis of the problem, I would say, I could say that it dates from the time of Euler. And in fact, the equations I'm going to write down are called the Euler equations. So that's an 18th century endeavor. And the boundary conditions that I'm going to write down for the velocity field and for the surface date have the name of one of the Bernoullis. Well, maybe it's not so old to say one of the younger Bernoullis, but nonetheless, roughly that time. Now, certain things that have come out of the analysis started, I think there was a big push in the 19th century in the UK. One thing that really was motivational at that time was Scott Russell's observations, more than an actual mathematical derivation. And he saw solitary waves. Actually, it was in the Union Canal. It's outside of Edinburgh. These are days of the Industrial Revolution, where they're building canals to transport things, goods to work. And it was before the railroad, when all the canals went out of business. And this was the origin. His observations actually were controversial and debated for 40 or 50 years. It's really the origins of what's now called soliton theory. And I'm not a soliton theorist, but it has been a big thing and a big paradigm in nonlinear physics for maybe 30 years. And well, such solitary waves, I won't even say what they are, but I'll say what's interesting about mathematics is once you study something, it can be applicable maybe in a small setting such as a laboratory wave tank up to a big setting such as, so that would be a wavelength of meter, up to a big setting where, such as the Pacific Ocean, where the wavelength can be 100 kilometers or several hundreds of kilometers. And it's the same basic description. So laboratory wave tanks through canals, through oceans, to tsunami waves, which a large span. And you can imagine the energy contained in one of the things. And the mathematics behind the theory of solitons is very beautiful. I'm not going to even start to attempt to describe it here. But it touches on and it's influenced many fields, some very applied fields, some very pure fields. So it's had its own impact on, say, algebraic geometry. Modern practice. Why does one look at these? Well, I put my own first, which is they're a challenge. They inspire my own sense of pleasure in studying a problem because it has the right feel for it. So, and I'm a mathematical analyst, so it's a challenge. It's an analytic challenge for mathematicians. Now, also, it's a very challenging problem in scientific computation, partly because the real relevance is in three dimensions, and three dimensions is maybe just barely getting started in our capabilities of accurately producing physical fluid dynamical phenomena. Now, more practically, people would study these mathematical problems if they wanted to design breakwaters or design harbors. Something I saw this summer is, it inspired me actually, is meteorologists make weather and sea state forecasting based on mathematical models. And that tells you that the sea is high here, but not dangerous for breaking, but the sea is high over here, but in fact inspiring breaking waves. So that don't sail your sailboat in the North Atlantic, sail a couple of degrees of latitude south, and you'll be less in danger. These kind of forecasts, they're produced daily, actually every couple of hours, by meteorological bureaus. The person I was talking to was from the Netherlands, the European Community Meteorological Center. And then stability of ship designs, stability of offshore platforms. If you build an oil platform, this is more expensive to make it taller, but if you put it in the North Sea, you'd like those storm waves in the North Sea not to be quite as high as that platform, or else you will experience severe stability problems. And so that's another reason for modern practice. Well, those are the very specific reasons to practice of that particular problem. But there's maybe a more global thing, and so I'm going to tell you what I think are romantic subjects to study in this realm of physically inspired or physically motivated mathematical results. It's one paradigm, at least when you abstract it, it's one paradigm of analysis of nonlinear equations of mathematical physics. So let me give you other examples. Here's quite a practical one, Maxwell's equations for electricity and magnetism. So when you have an optical waveguide, it's light going down, light going down a fiber, and with an index of refraction. Engineers really do solve Maxwell's equations in this waveguide, which is a partial differential equations. And as the geometry changes and as the index of refraction changes, or maybe they go into optical devices other than simply a long cable, you want to know the behavior of a solutions of those partial differential equations. And that gives rise to things like enhanced bandwidth, so enhanced rates of communication in optical devices. And even if you don't just have a wire, but you have junctions and switches and other more complex devices, these are the elements that are going to be needed in the next, I don't know how to predict this, 5 to 10 years in trying to build optical or partially optical computers. Well, that's quite a practical one. Nonetheless, Maxwell's equation is a nice classical field theory dating a good century and a half. General relativity. That I always found, ever since I was an undergraduate, found it a very romantic subject. You're not building something that's a device for engineers at this point, but you are trying to study something which is fundamental to our concept of the universe. And these are also posed as nonlinear partial differential equations. And in fact, they have a time evolution, so they also fit into my little niche of interesting problems. They're like this, and a lot of the paradigm, it's a similar paradigm. I don't say it's a similar result as what I'll talk about for nonlinear waves. That's in the great big world. Well, quantum mechanics is similar. This is one of the things you can do in mathematics, is study something enormously large, such as the groups of galaxies, and come up with an equation which is similar or of similar character or similar classification as when you're studying the smallest of the small, that is, quarks interacting, or maybe just classical electrons. I have a good warm feeling for quantum mechanics myself. Gauge theory, that's another beautiful subject. I can't say I've contributed that much to it, but there are beautiful connections with geometry, including until Seiberg and Witten came along, it was the way to study the topology of four manifolds, was to know about the physics of Yang-Mills fields bundles built over certain very specific Lie groups. And then to talk about modern physics, string theory, or theory of D-brains, if you make your strings higher and higher dimensional. Well, we don't even know the equations yet, so as mathematicians, maybe we can dive in and try to figure out their equations, or I don't know, maybe our game is sit and wait until they have a well-defined set of equations and can communicate them to us in an intelligent way. I think they're still working on the coordinates. But let's keep our ears open. That's what I'd like to do. Anyway, that's my list of problems. Now, I wasn't going to give you the equations yet, but hold on, I will. Well, I want to tell you a little bit about some of my own activities. So this is a wave tank. And this is a wave tank in a laboratory of some of my friends at Penn State. And they and we talk about waves and water at this point. And I just wanted to show you the wave tank. It's a little bit hard to interpret here, I think. Anyway, this is some stuff underneath the tank, so I'll lower it. And then you can see these two chromium rails. That's on this side of the tank, so I don't fall in. The photographer doesn't fall in. And this is the other side of the tank, so somebody on the other side doesn't fall in. And this blue beam is this big girder on which to put paddles. And this photo was taken the second day that this tank was filled up, so they hadn't got the paddles all lined up yet. They only had 8. And so what they did is they put another I-beam they had just floating around the lab. You can see this black thing is another I-beam they had putting in a lab, just so I make those 8 paddles run in a little channel. And they said, this is an experiment, but let's just see if they work. And they turned it on, and I want to show you that out come these very beautiful patterns of waves. You can look on the surface and see essentially hexagonal pattern. This is not by design or anything. This is just, let's see the paddles work. And beautiful hexagons come out and travel down the wave tank. And then on the bottom, you see this hexagonal pattern moving down the wave tank. And if you want to be really careful, you see that this bar fits with that hole. So anyway, I'll leave the equations up for a bit. And I actually find it fun that as a mathematician, I can go and talk to these people. And I like listening to what they say to me, and it's really kind of flattering when occasionally I say something and they think it's good. Here's where they actually is an experiment. All the paddles are up now, and they are trying to get a profile which looks like an elliptic function cut this direction, and essentially a cosine or something, a complex oscillation in this direction. And of course, this is a real wave tank, and the illumination is behind you. It looks pretty dramatic. If I turn the lights out, it looks even more dramatic. Is this better? They made that pattern because they said, describe this. And in fact, it's not bad fit for the cubic nonlinear Schrodinger equation. This is my friends at Penn State who are running this experiment, are Joe Hammack and Diane Henderson. They really took these photos not very many months ago. Now, a PhD student of mine, and one of the reasons we are in discussion is a PhD student of mine at Brown has been doing these calculations. I'm putting them on sideways, so they look like those patterns. They're really, of course, to read it is this way, but they look like those patterns. And this is rather practical. This is a computer program. I like to think that these are the best in the business so far for modeling of 3D traveling surface waves. And look how hexagonal they are. And also a sign of nonlinearity is how flat those troughs are and how tight those crests are. Those are really quite high and tight. And it's an elegant program where for scientific computation, you can say it's a spectral method based on the fast Fourier transform, something like that. But the actual methodology to make this calculation is based on an old theorem of Hadamard, actually a formula of Hadamard. It's called the Hadamard variational formula. And I'm not sure if you know what that is. But I'll tell you what, when you take my course, we'll learn about it. And then when they up the amplitude, they get this, and that's our challenge. You can see one of their graduate students here in the edge. Oh, the paddles, you can design it. So, you can't really quite have a continuous function. So they're like little steps in a step function, which is to approximate your continuous function. And they're computer controlled with quite accurate motors. So you can get strong motors which are really very accurate, and they are pushing the water with a certain profile in its depth just at the right time. So when I said that they were making a Jacobi elliptic function crosswise profiles, they are programmed to have a certain in a time series independently in that's x2 a crosswise, so that out comes the specified profile. So I mean, if you see what I mean, we're looking for a pattern which is actually a three-dimensional pattern in space and one in time, so it's a four-dimensional object. And you take a trace, that's the front of the paddles, so it's only three dimensions. And then you design your paddles to do that, and they get busy and do it. And you have lots of computers and cables running that, and in fact, it draws a fair amount of current. So now the thing is, describe that. Well, okay, we can't do that yet. That's a good point. It's a question of stability. Our group project on this hasn't hit at that barrier quite yet, but we've hit more subtle instabilities, where, you know, I have to go back to this picture with those nice bars across. Excuse me a second. There's an instability which is a result of a very recent PhD thesis at the University of Colorado, where these bars, for the right parameter settings, these bars start to wobble. And also these lanes of zigzag start to meander. And that was similar to what's called a Sakharov-Rubicek instability, but it's new and different. And ultimately, you can actually lose nodes. If they wander far enough, and this lags far enough, you can clip them off somewhere down the channel. But you're pushing me to talk more about the details of it than I wanted, and also more applied math than I wanted. But let's just leave that. And then here's a cool experiment. I just have a photo from a journal where they make beautiful patterns. Look at those horseshoe patterns. And so the waves are moving in this direction, and then they get really high, and then they form these horseshoes like that, and then they're staggered behind these V's back here. I think it's a very, very beautiful. It'd be nice to try to explain that, and there's been controversy up and down in the literature. In my own mind, it's a Hamiltonian saddle node bifurcation of a certain class of Hamiltonian system, but I just wanted to show you the picture, really. And then, just to say that those are waves in... That was in a large outdoor experimental facility, but not everything is an experiment. So I want to show you this beautiful wave. So I can see you get the whole thing on it. This is actually not exactly simply a gravity wave, but this is a tidal bore. And there are people who go around the world surfing on the cool tidal bores. And this is one of the places. There's a nice one. This is in Alaska. And here's a surfer in full wetsuit, you can imagine, with the peaks above him. And what I liked is just that beautiful crescent curve. And I think it'd be lovely to study shapes of those nonlinear waves. It's an excuse to show you a photo. This is up a very long and also very cold inlet in Alaska. I promised to give you some equations, so I'm going to move on to do that. Because, in fact, my field is partial differential equations. And so back to our diagram, which looks like that, because I wrote it more or less with the same pens, I want to tell you the equations of motion. So because it's a mathematical model, after all, and I have to describe what you do in the mathematics. So let's see. Back to our surface, as over there, and the velocity field u, as over there. And as the fluid evolves, what is our first equation of motion? Well, as the fluid evolves, it changes its shape. So I'm going to time 0. So S0 is a little box of fluid. I'm taking in the fluid. And then as time moves on, G of T is a transformation. It's a family of diffeomorphisms, depending on T, which bends this and moves it around, because that's what the fluid is doing. And I want to know what are the rules for that bending for every possible box in the fluid. And well, one way to get at least one of the first equations is any flow has to satisfy that its derivative at that point is the velocity vector field at that point. Because that's what it says. It says the fluid is moving according to its according to the vector field that it's it's given. And then you take a derivative with respect to x of this. So you basically take the Jacobian of the transformation of g, and you evaluate that at t equals 0 because it's equivalent to any other point, and you'll find that, and you take its determinant, which is the volume, and you'll find to preserve volume. Ah, yeah. So that's what I have to say. The fluid moves, but actually it moves in a way which does not, which distorts it all over the place. It's a fluid, but you can't compress it. And so to preserve volume, which is the determinant of the Jacobian, you have to have the trace of the vector field equals 0 in the fluid domain S. So that's already one thing we know about the U, is that a divergence-free vector field. Sorry? G is a family of diffeomorphisms, which is a diffeomorphism of the fluid starting at time t to a fluid later on. That's not the surface. It's the whole fluid domain moving. I haven't given the surface conditions yet. And then an assumption that goes on, assumption that that people make to study this problem, which is not true behind a jet engine or behind even a propeller of a ship, and it's not true looking at the whole North Atlantic because of Coriolis force, but it is true for, say, Lake Ontario, is that the fluid is pretty much rotation-free, where the curl, or the rotation of the vector field U, is this combination using the Einstein convention, summation convention, and it's often called omega, the vorticity. So I'm going to look at flows where the vorticity is zero. I'll put it up over here. Now, what I want to say is the vorticity is an interesting object. The vorticity equals zero is even maybe more interesting because it's a compatibility condition. It says that if every component of the vorticity, this is the vorticity, if every component is equal to zero, it says that dxi of uj has to be dxj of ui. It's obvious if I is equal to j. It's not true necessarily if j is equal to I, but for irrotational flows, it is. And now this is the compatibility condition that says that uj should be the jth derivative of a function phi, because second derivatives commute. And locally, that's true, and in such nice slabs, which are simply convective domains, it's true for, to say, if you want to be fancy, for cohomological reasons. So it says that uj is the jth derivative of potential function phi. So these are what are called potential flows, particularly simple flows. And in vector notation, u vector is the gradient of phi. And now let's just do the vector calculus. Zero is divergence of u, which is a divergence of the gradient of phi. That's Laplacian. So these are harmonic functions. So what are the equations of motion? They are, u find the surface. I still have to tell you that. U find the surface. And then at every point in the surface, all the flow underneath it is given by the gradient of a harmonic function satisfying certain boundary conditions on the surface, particularly simple flow. It's an interesting thing. It's not an elliptic equation, despite the fact that there's a Laplacian there. But that's a mistake that many mathematicians and engineers have made. So proposition is, u is a gradient of a harmonic function. That's what I said. What I want to do is describe, even before I do the boundary conditions, I want to give you, what's the energy of the flow? Well, if I'm in freshman physics, energy is, the kinetic energy is 1/2 times, I'm setting mass to be 1 because density is 1. I'm sort of calibrating it. Density is of water. I'm changing all my physical constants so the density of water is 1 in this. That means I have to have different physical constants in Alaska because it's a lot colder than in the Amazon. So the energy of a little piece of fluid is 1/2 times the velocity squared. Well, the velocity is grad phi, so it's 1/2 grad phi squared. Now, the total kinetic energy is I add it all up. That's the integral over the fluid domain. That's the kinetic energy, and I put Ke for kinetic energy. Now, the potential energy is how high it is above some reference frame, above some reference point. And so Ke should be the acceleration of gravity, g times y. Integrate that up in the y coordinate, and you get this number. So this is a potential energy. And that's the energy. It turns out this is a fundamental quantity. And Sakharov wrote a paper in 1968, which nobody understood for 20 years, and actually people are still bickering over it, which says you get the equations of motion on the surface from this energy, and you do it the following way. What are your coordinates? Well, now I have to stand back a second and say, well, this is also what mathematicians do. I just told you x and y were the coordinates. But in fact, I'm studying a partial differential equation as a dynamical system. That is, I want to study the evolution of a fluid. So my coordinates are the functions involved, and I want to move t through a family of functions. That's not g, and that's not x, and it's not and not y. It's I want to find the configuration of the continuum as time varies. And Sakharov took this point of view, and he said, the coordinates of phase space is now like a Hilbert space. The coordinates of phase space are going to be the possible surface elevations and the boundary values of the velocity potential. A lot of people have said, oh, they must be the velocity potential, but actually, this is a function of this and that, and it's wrong. So these two things, if you just take that and follow your nose, just take that mystical, mysterious statement and follow your nose, you find these boundary conditions for the surface and for the potential evaluated on the surface. And these are the classic ones. This is called the kinematic condition, and I told you the Bernoulli condition. And you derive these two things. So they're complicated nonlinear equations that I don't want to talk about too much in this venue. But you find this as the gradient with respect to the xi, remember, is a function of the Hamiltonian energy h. And d by dt of phi is the minus the gradient with respect to eta of the Hamiltonian energy functional h. And this is the typical form of a Hamiltonian system. So in my last slide, except for a couple of pictures, I want to derive at least one consequence of that, because every talk should have a theorem, I think. No, talks can have huge amounts of theorems. I've given you one proposition. But every talk should have a proof, and so I'll give you a proof. And so here is the proof of the thing I'm going to say. I guess I should have called it a theorem, but really it's just a proposition. Smooth the solutions of those equations for water waves, which I talked about. That is, Laplacian phi equals 0, that's going to give us our velocity. And then these two boundary conditions on the free surface, those conserve energy. This is the law of theorem, which is the law of conservation of energy for this PDE. And to say that, they satisfy the relation. Eta at time x and t, at time t, h of eta at time t, xi of time t, remember those are integrals of eta and xi and their derivatives, equals eta at x at 0 and xi at x at 0. So when you calculate h at time 0 and then you solve these equations and find out what happens at later time, you have the same h. And here is the proof. Let eta and xi be a solution. So eta depends on x and t, xi depends on x and t. Then you do the following thing, d by dt of h of eta and xi. And I know these sit in function spaces, and you have to take functional gradients, which are known as Fréchet derivatives usually, but do it anyway, and use a chain rule. It's grad of h with respect to eta times d eta by t, plus grad of h with respect to xi times d xi by dt. Now, d eta by dt, according to this slide, is grad xi of h, and that's been an out-of-focus piece of that. So let's put that in. That's here. Xi by dt, using that slide, is equal to minus grad eta of h. So put in minus grad eta of h, plus minus equals 0. It's just one of the canonical tenets of having a PDE be a Hamiltonian system, is that h, that is energy, is conserved. Okay, so I just want to finish with my last couple of minutes with some things. And instead of giving you a set of statements of theorems, I thought I'd show some pictures. So why study waves? Well, if your boat is sailing into this, you want to know what's happening, or you want to know where that's going to happen. In fact, I had that on my screen yesterday while I was doing some stuff. So this is too frightening, so I took it off and put something a little bit more benign. But this you don't. This is hard, rough on you if you're a sailor. So you like to predict. And that's, if you can predict with a pencil and paper, or if you can predict with a computer, you'd rather do that predicting than with your sailboat. Here's a cool picture. I just got it because it's cool. It's called this kind of break in this particular place. This is a beach in Fiji. It's called cloud break. I think it's because off the crest. Maybe you can tell I'm from California. I want to show you something a little bit cleaner than that. There's a purpose to my madness. It's not just cool photos. There's a beautiful curl. Oh my God. And you want, and things that you want to predict is how much energy is lost in this shh. That is the energy, there's a certain amount of energy in this wave, and it's dissipated and probably heats up the wave a little bit and adds, entrains air, probably entrains pollutants. And then the wave carries on. Well, if it's, this is actually on a beach, so it's not. But if it were open ocean, you'd lose something, and it would carry on. And that's a dissipative effect, and you'd like to predict that. And there's more dissipation if waves are breaking than if they're not, so you'd like to predict that. How much is coming over? What momentum is lost in all that frothy stuff? Okay, and then, so let's keep that. I actually had another one, but I want to put this one back. This is a cool one, too. Actually, the color didn't come out quite as nice as the actual photo. That greenish is sort of a, where the shadow and light of the sun are. Never mind, I'll put this back on. What I want to show you is some computations of a postdoc of ours. I'm going to leave this on and come over here and show you some. These are beautiful numerical computations of a postdoc of ours. These are for his PhD. And one of the messages is, if you, this is your bent, you can do it too. So let me get this so it doesn't blow away. He started with a solution. This is a numerical study. Given those differential equations that I gave you, which I sort of fleshed up, fleshed down, but I agree, but we can talk about them later when you're nicely enrolled in our graduate program. This is Neumann conditions on the bottom, but I haven't shown you the bottom. There's a bottom which is slightly shoaling here with a bump in the middle of it, so it's going to be break the symmetry a little. And on the top, I gave you the two boundary conditions. It's Laplace's equation in the region, and then there are two boundary conditions on top, which they're here. Just a sec. Just because that's a, it's a good thing to know that those are these boundary conditions. This and this. They're double, two boundary conditions that hold on the free surface. On the free surface. Yeah. So you might know from differential equations that you have equations and the boundary conditions. Those are the boundary conditions, and they change in time. So these are numerical calculations. I'm just going to go through. There are four slides, and then I'm going to stop. So here's a beautiful wave coming in, actually coming into a slight shoaling to make it break. And you notice there's a little bit of change here. It's steepening, and there's a little bit of change. And here it's getting stronger. So it really is coming into the beach, and it's no longer a graph anymore, and it's reparametrized in Lagrangian coordinates here. And here it is really a plunging breaker. So this is really a plunging jet of a breaker designed to be right in the middle. We see a little bit of instability along here, which may be resolved if they have a bigger cray with more time, because their mesh is not absolutely fully resolving the issue, but that's pretty dramatic. And I just wanted to show you a side view of that for comparison purposes. And there's that curl. And it's going the wrong way, so let me do it this way. Sorry about the backwards writing, but now you can see a certain similarity. It's not so bad, I would say. And as far as I'm concerned, this is effectively the best in the business internationally. I've seen one other paper which does approximately as good. It's an MIT team. And this is Philippe Guyen's work. So I want to stop here with these dramatic pictures on the board. And I don't want to tell you about any of my theorems. And I'll turn the lights on and you can stop.